afternoon and welcome everyone to today's internet web seminar titled Understanding Arsenic from Vasculature to Vegetables. This web seminar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. It is the third in the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program's 2011-2012 series designed to share Superfund research that aligns with scientific needs and EPA. Our presenters have already given a live seminar to project managers at EPA Region 9 headquarters and are reprising their presentations today to reach an even larger audience interested in arsenic issues. I'm Sarah Wilkinson, Research Translation Corps Coordinator with the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program, and I will be the moderator for today's session. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page in case you have any questions after the presentation today. For those of you joining via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have question and answer sessions, at which point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that phone participants keep your phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on mute. After you ask your question, please place your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or by using your phone's mute button. Once again, that's *6 to mute and *7 to unmute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations may have hold music or advertisements that can be disruptive to the call. By now, those of you participating via the phone line should have the presentation open and should be on slide 1. All of those presenting via the internet should have clicked on the Go To Session icon near the bottom of the page and should also be on slide 1 of the presentation. As explained on slide 2, the main page contains the slides above which you will find navigation icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide and need not wait until the Q&A period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit an answer of the Q&A session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you're encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached and we'll try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slide to which he or she is moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our links page where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the link page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack. In the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information, or CLUIN, archive. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute, and again, please do not put us on hold. Our first presenter for today is Dr. Todd Kamanish. Dr. Kamanish was born and raised in North Central Illinois. He served in the U.S. Navy as a hospital corpsman with a majority of his service as a Marine medic. Todd also served as a first responder, becoming a lieutenant in the Orange County Rescue Squad in North Carolina. He earned a B.S. from the University of Arizona and a Ph.D. from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He focused his studies on genetic engineering to create models for development and disease. He further trained as a research fellow at the Mayo Clinic. He is now a tenured associate professor in the Pharmacology and Toxicology Department with membership in the Seal Children's Research Center and Bio5 Institute. Dr. Kamanish is the incoming associate director of the Superfund Research Program at the University of Arizona and has recently formed Arizona Cancer Therapeutics, LLC, to support the further development of anti-cancer drugs into the clinic. Todd has served on numerous committees for the National Institutes of Health, the Children's Heart Foundation, and the American Heart Association, including grant review sections and policy boards. He is a member of several professional associations and is currently vice president of the Catalina Foothills School District Governing Board. Todd is also a passionate advocate for high-quality public education and health care. And with those glowing remarks, today he will be discussing his work on using a mouse model as an intact system to reveal mechanisms of arsenic-triggered cardiovascular toxicity during development. Take it away, Dr. Kamanish.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, depending where you are around the world. Thank you for tuning in and giving us this opportunity to share some of our work. So I think we're on page 3, which is the title slide. And so we'll go ahead and advance to page 4, and we're going to talk about arsenic as a cardiovascular toxicant. So inorganic arsenic, the key sort of talking or take-home points for today is that we believe heart is a target of arsenic toxicity. I'm going to show you some evidence for that, for arsenic-inducing hypertension and hypertrophy of the heart. Also, a brief data slide on altered vascular matrix deposition that indicates that there's a loss of key extracellular matrix molecules around blood vessels that may lead to cardiotoxic events. And then finally, the developmental aspect, where we show disruption of key cardiac developmental processes, particularly to the epithelial to mesenchymal cell transition, or the EMT process. So on the next slide is, why do we study arsenic? Well, everybody tuning in probably has an interest in this, so I don't need to belabor this slide too much, but chronic arsenic exposure is a worldwide problem. It is also a problem here in the desert southwest region of the United States. Arsenic has been well studied in relation to multiple cancers, such as skin, liver, and bladder. And more recently, with some nice epidemiologic work, there are links to cardiovascular outcomes, including heart disease, diabetes, and atherosclerosis. And you can see on this slide that there's multiple sources for exposure. And the top one shows a dust devil that is common to us here in Arizona. And then where the star is a source of water for many of us. That have well water or blended water could be an issue. And on the next slide gives you more of a flavor of what happens in Arizona. And I'm not sure why it's not loading. Okay. It's just happening for us. Okay, so there's communities that are juxtaposed or very close to mining operations. So mining is a one of the seeds of Arizona. So copper is produced abundantly in Arizona, and you can see on the slide to the left-hand side, there's several mining operations there, and there's communities such as Green Valley and other ones that are very close to these. So the mine waste, the mine tailings, they stack up, and so on high wind days, those can be blown and introduced into the air as, and carried in particulate matter, and they can also work their way down into water sources and groundwater. And on our Superfund, we have other sites in Arizona. So the slide to the upper right shows a minor dust storm occurring on top of a dry mine tailing stack. And there's a couple of our researchers there in full protective gear braving the windstorm while they're doing research on these tailings for remediation. And then when it rains, these mine tailings that have several toxic metals, including arsenic, turn into this red sludge, and that eventually leaches and gets down into groundwater sources. So arsenic in water and dust is a growing concern. So I'm not going to talk too much today on at all about cancer or genetics, but on this slide, they're highlighted as well. But arsenic and disease in relation to cardiovascular has been well documented for peripheral vascular diseases, such as the severe form of peripheral with the Blackfoot disease. Circled, I'm going to talk about hypertension today, and then developmental impact, particularly to cardiac developmental processes and vascular matrix. And the next slide just gives you an overview and impact. This is a map of the Bangladesh area. There are probably people tuned in from that area or from the Superfund projects, like from Colombia, that investigate this area of the world and population. But the take-home message from a lot of this work is that there's a much greater contribution to mortality, specifically from arsenic exposure, than was previously appreciated. And there's believed that up to 1/4 of all deaths, for example, in these particular regions in Bangladesh are attributable to arsenic exposure. On the next slide, I think we're on slide 9, with that introduction, leads us to one of the projects that we're doing in our laboratory in Superfund, on deciphering the impact of arsenic on the cardiovascular system, particularly the heart and blood vessels. So does arsenic impact structural heart development? Another question is, what are the mechanisms then of action of developmental exposure to arsenic? Is it cardiotoxic? And then whether this exposure to arsenic early in life and during key critical developmental periods leads to cardiovascular disease or predisposes to cardiovascular diseases later in adulthood. And then finally, whether this impact of arsenic on the cardiovascular system is preventable or, more importantly, reversible. On the next slide, it's just a listing of some key epidemiologic papers on arsenic and cardiovascular disease. The first one shows increased prevalence of hypertension and long-term arsenic exposure, and this really linked the duration, concentration, and cumulative exposure with the incidence of hypertension in people. The next paper also showed an increased ischemic heart disease-related mortality rate with a cumulative exposure to arsenic. The third paper showed a dose-response relationship that significantly related to hypertension from the exposure. And then again, that study with Bangladesh linking a large percentage of cardiovascular deaths directly attributable to arsenic in their water. So studying arsenic as a cardiovascular toxicant on slide 11, I'm going to talk about the first aim, where our hypothesis was that chronic arsenic exposure led to altered vascular integrity and promoted hypertension and ventricular hypertrophy. We used a mouse model for this system, an FEV strain exposed to 100 parts per billion sodium arsenite for almost 6 months, for 5.5 weeks. And then in aim two, I'll talk about the developmental impact with the hypothesis that arsenic disrupts cardiovascular developmental programming and patterning of the heart, showing the impact on the developmental epithelial to mesenchymal transition, or EMT, and the inhibition of key developmental gene programming in that EMT process. So in the first aim, what we did was we used mice. Immediately after weaning, we started them either on sodium chloride as a control or sodium arsenite, 100 parts per billion for each of those, carried them out to 5.5 weeks, and we routinely measured the blood pressure in a non-invasive COTA Kent Scientific instrument, which is a tail cuff pressure system. And then we also performed echocardiography on the animals and live animals. And at the end of the study, once the animals were put to sleep, we covered the hearts and aortas, and we performed histopathology to correlate with any of the echo and blood pressure findings. So on the next slide, which is the first data set slide, slide 13, shows the data on the hypertension. And the dark lines, so the dark filled lines with the boxes, or the dashed dark line with the circles, those are the experimental animals, or those that were exposed to 100 parts per billion. And then the lighter colored lines, which appear gray on this slide, were the control animals. And so you can see with time on the x-axis of weeks going out and blood pressure reading on the y-axis, after about 4 to 5 weeks, there is an increase and sustained increase in systolic blood pressure in the sodium arsenite-treated animals compared to controls, and there was a trend for an increase in the diastolic blood pressure as well. Looking at these in aggregate, at the end of the study, we saw a 34-point increase in systolic blood pressure for the arsenite-treated animals compared to controls, and a 22-point increase in diastolic with the arsenic compared to controls. So these, for the systolic, that was a significant increase in the blood pressure. And again, it was sustained out through the time course. So this indicated that chronic hypertension, or chronic exposure to arsenic, resulted in hypertension. And I should note that these are in female mice, which was similar to epidemiologic data in human populations. And we do know that chronic hypertension causes a constant stress on the heart. It's a major problem in Western civilized developed nations. And so with that in mind, we knew that there was a pressure overload occurring on the heart, meaning that the left ventricle has to work harder to overcome that resistance. So there's an increased afterload. It could be a decreased cardiac output. But in other words, basically the heart needs to work harder to keep up with the body's oxygen demand. The muscle gets bigger, and this is what's referred to as cardiac hypertrophy. So the question is, if we're seeing, or our hypothesis was, if we're seeing this hypertension, then we should see cardiac hypertrophy. So to examine that, on the next slide shows that we used echocardiography in these animals to look for changes in the heart muscle and function. I'm not going to get into a lot of details because the real-time movie, I guess, doesn't work on the webinars, but it takes some technical patience and talent to get really good echoes on mice, but once you have it set and working, it's a great mouse HMO system. So the gold standard for diagnosis of left ventricular hypertrophy is through echocardiography. We use the M-mode analysis, for those in cardiology understand what that is, to get a good view of the heart. So the top of this slide just shows the sort of the slice that we're going through in a simple anatomic picture of the heart. And when we do this, we now analyze many physiologic parameters. And the one that we're going to talk about, we'll skip the next slide because that movie will not work, is shown on slide, I think it's 17. Mm-hmm. So if you compare, the top panel 2A, there's tracings that are in a light blue line, and those are tracings showing the anterior wall, and then on the bottom, the posterior wall. And the same tracings occur down in panel 2B. And you get to see with your own eye that there is an increase in area in the tracings for the anterior and posterior wall in the sodium arsenite, the arsenic-treated animals, compared to the top panel. And so what we can do is actually measure that area and use a formula to calculate the left ventricular mass. So in the clear bars in the chart to the right shows the left ventricular mass from controls compared to the filled bars from those treated with 100 parts per billion arsenite. And you can see there's a significant increase in the left ventricular mass of the arsenic-treated animals, indicating that there is ventricular hypertrophy in the experimental mice. So on the next slide, at the end of the study, performing histology on the mice are just some cross-sections in 3A and 3B. And 3A is control mice. 3B are the sodium arsenite-treated mice. And you can see there is an increase in the size or the mass of the ventricular muscle. So similar, just supports what we saw in echocardiography. There's higher magnification in panels 3C and 3D. So if you just measure through multiple measurements, the line kind of gives you an indication. We would do about 10 of these measurements and then calculate basically the length of an intraventricular septum mass. And there is an increase in the arsenic-treated animals compared to the control animals. Again, comparing the filled dark bars to the clear bars on the chart to the right. So this was consistent to what we measured in the echocardiography of the mice. So there's two types of hypertrophy that can occur. So there's eccentric hypertrophy and concentric. One is considered pathology related, and the other one is like high exercise demand related. So someone who's a marathon runner will have eccentric hypertrophy, where you have an overall increase and a healthy increase in the heart to keep up with the demand of the body, where concentric is where you get a disproportionate increase in the muscle, heart muscle, with a decrease in the lumen size, and that's not something you want, and that's concentric hypertrophy. And since we identify both by echo and histo that there is hypertrophy occurring, we want to determine which of these was occurring due to the arsenic exposure. One way to do this is to basically do a couple measurements. where you measure the ventricular heart wall thickness compared to the diameter of the lumen during diastolic conditions. And it's called a relative wall thickness. And so if you have a relative wall thickness that's 0.45 and above, that's considered concentric hypertrophy, or the bad kind that you don't want. And so in comparing a handful of our controls, again in the clear bars, compared to a number of animals that were exposed to arsenite, you can see that in all of the experimental animals, we calculated concentric hypertrophy at a greater incidence compared to controls. So this indicated that the hypertrophy we were seeing is concentric hypertrophy, or the pathology-related type. And then finally, looking at blood vessels at the same arsenic-exposed concentration, there's a panel shown here. Looking at the top two images are elastin or elastic fibers present both in the tunica intima and lining the adventitia layer. So you can see the green fluorescence that's highlighting with the white arrows the elastin. And in the arsenic-treated group, you can see that's disrupted. The pattern of its deposition isn't uniform as it is in controls. The middle panel is looking at the smooth muscle cell layer, typically the tunica media layer. You see a nice detection in the compact tunica media layer in the controls in panel E, but in panel F, you see it's less detected and it's more diffuse, so we believe there's a dropout of bona fide smooth muscle cells in that vessel in the arsenic-treated animals. And then in the vascular matrix around the whole vessel, you can see nice detection of collagen, a robust detection of collagen in panel G. And in panel H, you can see there seems to be a fallout, or at least a disruption or a lack of deposition of intact collagen in the arsenic-exposed animals. So we're seeing central heart effects, and we're also seeing peripheral vascular matrix effects due to exposure to arsenic. And so our continued work is what comes first, you know, or is it a combination of both effects on the periphery, on the vessels, and also central heart effects. So some of the future studies that we want to continue on are do some blood biochemistry to see if we can identify and define biomarkers that are related to the defined cardiovascular diseases we are seeing. And there's a number of them listed here, but I just wanted to point out that we have some initial observations for CRP, which is C-reactive protein. And I believe the next slide actually has a blow-up of that. Okay, next slide, sorry. So the number is 23. So detection of C-reactive protein in mouse serum is not optimal. It's not as good as it is in humans, but detecting it in tissue itself can be done. And so we looked at mouse livers. Liver is a main producer of this acute phase protein, C-reactive protein, or CRP. So looking at a couple of controls and a handful of sodium arsenite-treated mouse livers, you can see minimal to no detection of CRP in those liver lysates from controls, and we see abundant or robust detection of C-reactive protein in the 100 parts per billion treated animals. So this gave us a clue that C-reactive protein might be considered as a potential biomarker in a panel of biomarkers. To support that, we looked at immunohistochemistry for detection of CRP in liver sections. Controls are on the left-hand side. The arsenic exposed are on the right-hand side. And what we do see is increased detection of CRP in liver sections that are in the arsenic-exposed groups, particularly in the medullary area. And so we believe this is consistent with the liver lysate, and they support each other, and that this, again, may be considered to be part of a blood test in humans, because most of the time you're not going to get liver biopsies from humans, as a surrogate serum biomarker for cardiovascular effects from exposure to arsenic. So the conclusions for this part and the implications are, that a lot of our observations are consistent with epidemiological reports, and we believe this in vivo mouse model is a strong system to study the cardiovascular outcomes in an intact animal system due, from problems from arsenic exposure, and may be used to further characterize biomarkers and correlate those with cardiovascular outcomes. We believe left ventricular hypertrophy, or LVH, is an independent cardiovascular risk factor, and this should be assessed in future epidemiologic studies for populations that are exposed to high, moderate, and even low chronic levels of arsenic in their drinking water or from other routes of exposure. And we'd like to expand upon defining potential surrogate markers to gauge the health risk from arsenic exposure. And we should consider organ-specific serum markers with exposure readouts. So I'd like to transition now on the next slide, slide 26, on the developmental impact, our cardiovascular developmental impact from arsenic exposure. And this is a real problem. Congenital heart defects in the United States, and for that matter probably worldwide, range from anywhere from 2 to 5%. It's the most frequently occurring birth malformation, and a high rate of miscarriages in the first trimester are usually related to structural heart developmental failures. And you can see circled on this slide that the majority of causes for congenital heart defects are not known, and we believe environmental agents and exposure to things that you should be exposed to contribute to a lot of these. So we also believe that there are developmental origins for cardiovascular disease in adults. So for example, you may have a minor structural heart defect that doesn't end development of the fetus or death of the infant shortly after birth, but you have a minor one that is not detected and will result later in life with heart disease from failing valves, or you may have a minor septal defect and form a clot and you can have a stroke. So there's a reemergence of understanding developmental origins for cardiovascular disease in adults, and we believe arsenic may be a contributor as an environmental factor. So on the next slide, 27, just a brief overview on cardiovascular development. By the second to third week, the heart tissues, the cells and heart tissues are already faded. They know what they're going to be. V is for ventricle, A is for atria, and this boomerang-looking tissue structure. And about a week later, that boomerang-looking cardiac mesoderm fuses into a linear heart tube. And you can see that on the day 21 image. And that heart tube is lined by the muscle or the myocardial cells. And the inner lining or the inner tube of that tube are the endocardial cells. So two cell types at this point in heart development. But at that linear heart tube stage, those labeled sections already know if they're going to be the outflow part on the top and vessels. In the middle are the ventricular tissues. And on the bottom, the RA and left A are the left and right atrial tissues. And there's already rhythmic contraction at this point. Then there's a rightward adductoral looping that occurs, and it starts to place the chambers, or the common chambers, in the correct anatomical positions. The common atria on top, the ventricles on the bottom, and then the vessel or outflow part is off to the left, the CT and AS area. That's a critical stage, that rightward looping, because it pushes tissues next to each other. And between the chambers, there's a swelling that creates the endocardial cushions, and also a swelling in the outflow part in between that CT region that forms the outflow tract cushions. So those cushions swell and close off, for example, between the atria and the ventricular, and they serve as primitive valves. And it's that cushion tissue that will become the actual bona fide leaflet of the valves and contribute to the septum that you see by day 50 in human heart development on the last image there. All the structures of the heart are formed by day 50 or so. So that fetus, infant, and person will have all the heart structures that are formed at that point for the rest of their lives. So anywhere along this developmental pathway, exposure to environmental toxicants like arsenic, for example, can disrupt these developmental processes. And of course, the earlier the exposure, the more broad spectrum the defects will be. So the heart is the first organ to form, and it needs to form as best it can to support the rapidly growing embryo and sustain life for the mammal throughout its lifetime. So the focus in on those endocardial cushions, the atrioventricular endocardial cushions of the heart. On the left panel shows a nice diagram where, again, the heart is outlined by the myocardium. The light blue cells are the endocardium or the inner lining. And then you can see the darker red or maroon cells in the cardiac cushion between the atria and the ventricular, and then on the left-hand side in the outflow tract part of the heart. And these dark maroon red-colored cells, those are the cardiac mesenchyme. So now we have a third cell type that's introduced to the heart at this stage. So we have the myocardium, the light blue endocardium, and then this cardiac mesenchyme. The cardiac mesenchyme is derived from those light blue endocardial cells. So initially, these swellings are acellular. It's all extracellular matrix. And then specific or select endocardial cells, the light blue colored cells, will receive signals and cues to undergo that epithelial to mesenchymal cell transition, or EMT. So they'll migrate, activate, they'll differentiate, and then they'll dive down into those cushions to remodel it into the valve leaflets that are on the right panel, that are in the darkish black to maroon color. So that cardiac mesenchyme will remodel those cushions into valve leaflets, such as the mitral valve, and also components of the septum, for example, the inferior part of the atrial septum, and then also the membranous part of the intraventricular septum. So I like to think that these endocardial cushion EMT and production of cardiac mesenchyme really remodels the heart and gives formation of the central heart structures, so sort of the geometric center of the heart. We and others have really characterized key players in this process, and those are listed on the bottom of the slide. TGF-beta family of ligands and receptors are critical and obligate for this process, especially TGF-beta 2 and a type 3 TGF-beta receptor. And hyaluronan, or hyaluronic acid, which is a carbohydrate, is deposited through hyaluron synthase 2 or HAS2 initially to swell those endocardial cushions. And then they also direct commitment and migration of those cells as they do the remodeling process into the valve leaflets and septum. And I bring those up now because there's a panel of markers that we'll look at to see if arsenic impacts those in a few slides down. So what do these look like for real? On the next slide, 29, this is detection of hyaluronan, or HA, in those forming endocardial cushions and AV canals. And we use immunohistochemistry, so anywhere you see in brown, that's the detection of the hyaluronan, or HA. And you can see it's robust detection and it's ubiquitous deposition. But you can see the swellings between the ventricle and the atria, that they swell so much that the endocardial cells will touch each other. And then what happens in panel B, you can see where the arrows are pointing to the cells within those cushions. Those are the cardiac mesenchymal cells. So they have been derived from the endocardium, turned into mesenchyme. They migrate into that hyaluronan-rich extracellular matrix. You can see it's surrounding the cells in a pericellular coat. And it's these cardiac mesenchymes then that remodel that tissue into the valves and septum. And panel C was just a control for the IHC method. So HA along with TGF-betas are necessary for normal heart structures. Well, how do we understand and look at this in a controlled system? On slide 30 shows an assay that was developed about 35, 40 years ago by Ray Runyon and Roger Markwald that we adopted and modified for using mouse endocardial cushions. So what we're able to do is microdissect out day E9.5 embryonic hearts, and we'll explant those onto type 1 hydrated collagen gels. Now, it works for the endocardial cushions at that stage where you can reproduce or recapitulate the EMT events in culture in panel A, and you will produce mesenchyme. You can introduce molecules such as dominant negative molecules or potentially active molecules and see if they can impact the EMT process. Another control you can use for gain-of-function studies is if you microdissect out in panel B the ventricular region, so not the cushion region of the heart, but the ventricular region, the endocardium of the ventricular region is not competent to undergo the EMT process. So you explant those onto type 1 cholangels, and if left alone, you will not see mesenchymal cell production. But you can put in gain-of-function molecules or consistently active molecules and see if that can drive the EMT process. So it is a very nice system to recapitulate the molecular and cellular events of EMT. Granted, you won't form a valve in this system, but you can understand the molecular pathway that's important in cardiac EMT. So what does this look like in a collagen gel? On the next slide, 31, on the left-hand side is a wild-type or naive cardiac cushion explant. It's a stacked confocal image where the cells were stained for vimentin, which is a known marker for mesenchymal cells, an intermediate filament marker, vimentin. And in panel A, we flushed off the myocardium that is on the gel so we could just see the mesenchymal cells that were produced. And so you can see the normal amount of EMT or cardiac mesenchyme that's produced after about 48 hours in culture on the type 1 collagen gels. Now in contrast, you could look in panel B and you can see a bunch, the myocardium is the large blob in the middle, and around that are a bunch of cells that look like fried eggs. And those clearly look different than the mesenchymal cells in panel A. And those are the endocardial cells that failed to undergo the EMT process. They aborted it because they were exposed to arsenite. And so this is our first hint that arsenic impacts cardiac developmental EMT. So we did a dose titration looking at various doses of sodium arsenite in this EMT collagen gel invasion system. And that's shown on slide 32. And you can see with increasing dose of sodium arsenite, you see a direct dose-dependent decrease in EMT or the production of cardiac mesenchyme. On the next slide, 31, we move to looking at slide 33. We look to looking at a progenitor, a cardiac progenitor cell line in collaboration with Joy Burnett at Vanderbilt Medical University. So I told you that EMT occurs in the endocardial cushion, endocardial cells. Well, there's another region where it occurs in the heart, and that's also with epicardial cells. So the epicardium is in the left-hand panel. You see the heart. The nuclear stain is in blue. The red is a marker for epicardial cells, and it lines the heart, so it's like the epicardial sac. And what those cells do when they execute EMT is that they produce cells that make up the coronary vasculature. So the lining of the vessel cells, the smooth muscle cells, and they also contribute to cardiac fibroblasts. So what we did was we used the SV40, our C antigen, the Mora mouse, crossed it to several of our other genetic models, but in this case we're using wild-type epicardial cells. And what's nice about this system is that this epicardial cell line with the large T antigen is temperature sensitive. So when you grow at 33 degrees, the cells are immortalized. When you take them and move them to a tissue culture incubator at 37, they revert back to being regular epicardial cells. So this allows us to do a lot of EMT assays in a much more reproducible and consistent manner. And so what they look like in culture is in the middle panel. That's a normal epicardial epithelial sheet of cells. And then when we would put on, for example, TGF-beta-2 and that panel, the third panel on the right-hand side, they start to transition into that cardiac mesenchymal cell phenotype. So now we use these and a modified collagen gel culture system on slide 34 to look at the impact of arsenic and can it disrupt TGF-beta-induced EMT. And so in panel A, it's just a control culture, very minimal to no detection of cardiac mesenchyme. In panel B, when we put on TGF-beta-2, about picograms per mil of TGF-beta-2, you can see induction, elongation, and migration out of cardiac mesenchymal cells due to the EMT process. And then the 2 pounds below are just the sodium arsenite by itself, and then sodium arsenite with TGF-beta-2. And if you can compare panel D to B, you can see that in the presence or exposure to arsenite, TGF-beta-2 CMT is lost. So clearly that showed us that inorganic arsenic disrupts or blocks TGF-beta-induced cardiac EMT. So now getting back to those molecules that I mentioned we know and have defined are very important to EMT or cardiac EMT. We did real-time PCR from RNA isolated from these cultures, both epicardial progenitor cell cultures and endocardial cushion explants. And this is shown on slide 35. And we looked at the expression of HAS2, TGF-beta-2, the type 3 receptor, or TBR3, periostin, which is a marker for mesenchymal cells, and slug and snail, which are downstream effector molecules of the TGF-beta pathway. And we did a dose of 10 parts per billion, or which is roughly about 0.134 micromolar of sodium arsenite. And you can see for all the genes that we looked at in this EMT gene profile, they were all knocked down in the presence of the arsenic. So this indicated that arsenic does disrupt the EMT gene program, and by extrapolation then, why we're seeing a reduction in production of cardiac mesenchyme. On slide 36, we actually looked for the carbohydrate hyaluronan, or HA, which is the product from that hyaluronan synthase 2 or HAS2 gene. And again, we see a dose-dependent decrease in that when arsenic is there, or when arsenic is in the presence of TGF-beta-2, indicating that again, inorganic arsenic blocks defined molecules necessary for developmental cardiac EMT. So without the genes on the previous slide and without HA being deposited into either the endocardial cushion or the epicardial space, you fail to get mesenchyme production. So conclusions and some implications from this part of the talk is that inorganic arsenic blocks cardiac EMT in both endocardial, primary endocardial cushion explants, and also in the epicardial progenitor cell model. The arsenic disrupts cardiac developmental EMT gene programming and HA deposition. And we believe that this disruption in these key cardiac developmental processes lead to disease in adults. So this could indicate, depending when exposure occurs, this could lead to developmental origins for disease in adulthood, contributing to cardiovascular mortalities in those populations that are living with a continued chronic exposure to arsenic. So the significance on slide 38 that we believe we have a powerful model for understanding arsenic-related cardiovascular pathologies, and that these understanding these molecular mechanisms will ultimately help us understand etiology, but hopefully prevent or reverse disease progression. Could this be done through supplementation, maybe through nutrient supplementation or some other process to prevent arsenic toxicity? And that possibly that cardiovascular toxicity should be a consideration when setting MCLs or the set limits by EPA for standards, for example, in drinking water. So I'd like to acknowledge our laboratory. The bulk of this work was done by Pavel Soria and Derek Broca in the laboratory, and our funding as well, and our collaboration with the Valancourt Lab for the C-reactive protein work. And we move on to the next talk, or do we take questions now?
We'll take time for questions now for Dr. Kamenish. Thank you for your presentation. So we'll have a few questions now for Dr. Kamenish, and then we'll have Monica give her presentation. At the end, we'll have time for questions to her, and we'll open it up again for questions for both speakers if anything comes to mind. I'll go ahead and take a few questions that we already have from the simulcast viewers, and if people on the phone want to stand by, you can unmute your phone in just a couple minutes and ask a question. Dr. Kamenish, one question from Andrew Schaefer with Waste Management in Houston, Texas is, you stated that the dose was 100 parts per billion. Is that 100 parts per billion per day, per week, or total over the 22-week exposure period? And what would the equivalent dose be in an average-sized human?
That's a good question. So we wanted to mimic sort of the real-world, situation, and since these are rodents, We just did at Livermore, just they were always had access to the water, so it was 100 parts per billion in their drinking water, and that was verified every week. So basically, we switched the water out every other day or every third day, and through ICPMS, we always made sure our doses were accurate and stable.
Okay, thank you. Another question from Sheila Abraham with the Ohio EPA is on slide 13, is there any explanation for the decrease in milligrams of mercury in week 14 followed by a spike in week 15 in the control, or is this not consequential?
No, that's a good question. That surprised us when we were doing it. So this system is a tail cuff pressure system. It's non-invasive. So we spent a lot of time up front acclimating mice to the system because you don't want them to be stressed because that will cause changes in blood pressures, obviously. So, you know, we kept cats out of the lab and stuff like that. No, I'm just joking. So it's a difficult system to get in place, but once you have it and they're acclimated, it works well. We think it's inconsequential because it happened with all of our animals, so we're not sure what happened in the environmental testing room that may have, you know, impacted maybe these blood pressure readings, but they all experienced it. But what was important to us is that the treated mice always had a higher detected level of blood pressure. So we're not sure if it was an environmental influence or if this was some sort of adaptation or physiologic response due to elevated blood pressure, then they adapted for some reason. So it could be environmental, it could be biologic, we're not sure. But for our results, we don't think it's consequential because we see the sustained increase, particularly to systolic blood pressure in arsenic-treated mice.
Okay, thanks. Let's take a moment to find out if anyone on the phone line has a question. If you would like to ask a question, you can take your phone off mute by pressing star 7, state your name and organization, and then ask your question. You can then remute your phone by pressing star 6. Do we have any questions from the phone? Okay, then we'll go back to the simulcast questions. One question from Tracy Punchin at Dartmouth College is, did you investigate the arsenic concentration and speciation in the liver?
No, we have not done that yet, but we're in the process of doing it, and we have a second cohort that we're doing that on right now.
Okay. Another question from Laura and Robin at FDA in College Park, Maryland is, what kind of supplementation do you think would be beneficial?
That's a good question. You know, we've heard from people potentially selenium is a possibility. Some talking from some other folks, and I think there was a recent paper maybe from ginger, some derivatives of ginger maybe can block or reverse effects from arsenic, but we have not experimentally explored those as of yet. So any ideas would be greatly appreciated.
Sounds like an opening for a great collaboration. We have some other questions from the simulcast. This is from Nazoon Menka at the University of Arizona. Is the 100 ppb the current estimated exposure in contaminated areas, or why was this amount chosen for the study?
No, good question. You know, the set limit right now is 10 parts per billion in drinking water set by the EPA. It was 50 parts per billion just, you know, 5-6 years ago. But there are tens of millions of people worldwide that are certainly exposed to 100 parts per billion and even much greater. A lot of animal studies have used levels much higher. We wanted to start with 100 parts per billion and then work down, and so we even have some studies that are doing lower amounts. So certainly there are a substantial number of people who are exposed to 100 parts per billion in the real world, including populations in the United States.
Do we have any questions from our phone line participants? Okay, one more question from the simulcast is from Amy Patton of Patton Environmental in Ashland, Oregon. She says, one slide showed that arsenic disrupts EMT at as low as 12.5 ppb arsenite. Did you do any tests with concentrations lower than 12.5 ppb? And do you have any recommendations to reduce EPA's MCL of 10 ppb arsenic or the MCLG of 0 ppb?
Yes, we've done below 12. We've done 10 and 5. 10 also blocks EMT. we see a partial reduction at 5 parts per billion with a concomitant, you know, partial decrease in those key EMT genes. Now, when we do the cell culture work, what we're finding is, compared to sodium arsenite, that the metabolites are much more toxic, maybe 24, our cells maybe are 20-fold more sensitive to the metabolite, for example, MMA3, which is a real concern because MMA3 is about, I think, 50% in blood and urine from people who have, you know, arsenic exposure. So that may be the real culprit, are those metabolites. That was one of our suggestions, is that I believe a lot of MCLs were set based on risk for developing or cancer, carcinogenesis. We feel that the impact on the cardiovascular system and disease should be taken into consideration on the next round of setting MCLs.
Is that someone on the phone trying to jump in with a question?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Doris Solarius in Prescott, Arizona. And my question is, have any studies been done to determine whether removal of the source of arsenic exposure would lessen effects later in development? You know, so that, you know, we haven't done these studies with people yet, but would, if, is living with constant exposure into adulthood significantly a worse situation? Or if you move away and drink clean water, are you much less likely to have heart problems?
No, I think that's an excellent question. And we don't really have, you know, the answer for that. We can't just extrapolate everything we find in the experimental system to what's happening, because each person metabolizes, for example, arsenic a little bit differently. Some people are more susceptible to others. There's other risk stratification indications for particularly cardiovascular, such as smoking, lifestyle things. But I think the general feeling is, anytime you're exposed to something that is potentially risky, if you could reduce or eliminate your exposure, it's probably going to be better in the long term.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no more questions for Dr. Kamenish, then we will move on to our second presentation. Monica Ramirez Andreata has a Master's of Public Administration in Environmental Science and Policy from Columbia University, and her undergraduate degrees are in Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and Photography from the University of Arizona. She is currently completing her PhD in Environmental Science, focusing on integrating the fundamentals of environmental science, human exposure assessment, and methods to positively harness community knowledge and activism. She is the former Research Translation Coordinator for the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program and has extensive experience transferring information and technology from researchers into the hands of stakeholders at all levels. Some of her activities include building linkages and partnerships with government agencies, creating innovative bilingual communication tools, and conducting informal science learning experiences for people of all ages. Today, she will report on her study, Garden Roots, the Dewey Humboldt Arizona Garden Project, which was designed to determine the uptake of arsenic and lead in commonly grown vegetables in Arizona and to evaluate the possible health risks to the local population. Take it away, Ms. Ramirez Andreata.
Thank you very much, Sarah. So hello, everyone. Thanks for being here with us. Again, like she said, I'm Monica, and I will be talking about Garden Roots, Protecting Communities Neighboring Contamination, a Transdisciplinary Approach to Determine the Accumulation of Arsenic in Vegetables. Next slide. So before I begin, I really want to give a massive shout out to the people that support, or the funding agencies that supported my research as well as my doctoral program that I'll be completing this year. U.S. EPA, ORD, the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, Sloan Foundation, the NASA Arizona Space Consortium, which really supported the public participation project portion of this project, Water Sustainability Program here within the University of Arizona from Arizona tax money, and of course my department, Soil, Water, and Environmental Science. If you go to the next slide, I'd another big shout out to the town of Dewey Humboldt within Yavapai County where Garden Roots was conducted. We'll get into more details with that later, as well as the Yavapai County Arizona Cooperative Extension Office and the director, Jeff Shalal, that you see in this picture. He was integral in helping me with sample collection as well as interacting with the community and helping me identify conduits within the community. So thank you all. So before I really jump into the research, I think it's really important for me to frame my entire project with a mission statement. And the mission statement that I operate from is that public participation in environmental science research improves the quality, legitimacy, and capacity of environmental investigations and decisions. So this is slide 43 where you can read my mission statement. But I want to highlight that in 2008, the National Research Council published a report entitled Public Participation in Environmental Assessment and Decision Making. And the report stressed the importance of public participation in environmental issues. And so they defined quality as identifies the values, interests, and concerns of all who are interested or might be affected by the environmental process or decisions. Legitimacy, to ensure that the process is seen by all interested and affected parties as fair and competent. And capacity as really trying to increase the communication and develop mutual trust between the agency, scientists, and the affected community. And so quality, legitimacy, and capacity, in turn, are the building blocks. And so I took this idea a bit further and say, let's involve the public in the actual environmental science research project being conducted at the site or within the community. And so I'll further back this up. Within a time where 74% of Americans worry a great deal or fair amount about the environment, yet 51% still put more of a priority on economic growth versus environmental issues, we are at a crossroads where work like with public participation in environmental science research is at the heart of many environmental solutions. So that's my massive soapbox statement for the day. Moving on to slide 44, Garden Roots, before I begin, is really a collaborative, co-created citizen science project. This is a form of public participation in scientific research and can be considered an informal science education activity. And most importantly, it's community-driven. So this project came about due to community interest and motivation and scientific inquiry. Next slide, with slide 45, you'll see the Garden Roots Project activities. So this is just giving you an overview of all the different aspects of Garden Roots. The projects or the statements with the orange dot are really the ones that I'll be highlighting today in this talk. So you will be discussing the greenhouse study, building a citizen science program to determine the levels of arsenic in the vegetables, characterizing the risk, delivering the results and designing a risk communication template to meet the needs and the community, and briefly talking about whether there was a difference in participants' knowledge, awareness, and behavior as a result of Garden Roots. So slide 46, introduction. So I'd like to stress that before Garden Roots could be started, there were research translation activities needed to be conducted as well as partnership building. So this project, as well as others, would really have never left the ground if it had not built a relation, if there wasn't a relationship building component with the Environmental Protection Agency, the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, as well as the community of Dewey Humboldt. Next slide. So some of you might remember me, in my introduction, I am the former research translation coordinator. And within that project, it's really about building partnerships. So in 2006, Mike Gill and I designed a collaborative seminar series that we called Live at Region 9, or a West Coast seminar series. And this was an important thing to have developed because it really gave us face time with the EPA project managers. So it allowed us as a research institution to match our research expertise with the research needs of the project managers who are working at the site. So at our first Live at Region 9 seminar in June 2007, or it might have been our second, we met with project managers and we learned about an upcoming NPL site. And then in March of 2008, that site was listed. And so this is a pivotal moment for us as a university to have learned about a site listing because we were able to then really start building collaborations with EPA to start doing research together at the site, And that's in May of 2008, where there, I hosted a teleconference with EPA ADQ and six other researchers here at the University of Arizona. Next slide. So in August of 2008 was the first community meeting I had attended, and community members from the Dewey-Humboldt area neighboring the site had approached me that they were expressed and they were concerned whether it was safe to grow and consume their vegetables, and they asked for assistance. To me, this was, a pivotal moment. The community brought a research question to us, to me, and we continue to have engagement with the community from October 2008 to 2011, going to Agua Fria Community Festivals, gathering more contacts and informational and community information, and maintaining that idea that was posed in 2008 and starting my PhD program. I received monies in February of 2010 from the Office of Research and Development through EPA, as well as those academic fellowships, to really carry out the project and research proposed by the community. So it was really in this time that recruitment began through community meetings, mailings, and advertisements. So the site introduction, so that's kind of giving you the background of what just needs to occur, to do collaborative research at a site if you want to have public participation. So the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site, again, was listed in March of 2008. It was periodically active for gold, silver, copper, lead, and zinc, and the major contaminants of concern are arsenic and lead. Next slide. Some selected social characteristics of the area: the population's around 4,000. There's about 1,600 households. This is a non-metropolitan community or rural. The majority of the population is Caucasian, and you can see about 70% have bachelor's degrees and above, and 93% are high school graduates. Next slide. So the garden roots, the next slide you should be on is, 51. So this is a garden root study area map, provided by Google. So the orange dots are representing of tailings. So you'll see on the left side, you'll see the large tailings pile. If you go to the other side of Highway 69, you'll see a smaller orange dot where that's the tailings dam failure, and then the large brown dot, which is the smelter and slag pile. So this is to put everything into perspective for the next set of slides. Next. So the next slide, you'll see that for the greenhouse study, which was a controlled greenhouse study where I selected vegetables and grew them in the greenhouse, those soils were collected from a residential area within 2 miles from the tailings. Next. This next slide you'll see is showing the number of community members who contributed samples within the less than two mile radius. And I believe that's around, let's just hold on a couple of seconds. 9 community samples were contributed less than 2 miles from the tailings. Next slide, you'll see that radius grow. Sorry, we're having a little bit of a slow download. 11 community samples were provided within 2 to 4 miles from the tailings and those highlighted areas. Next slide. Yeah, again, sorry. I'm going to just take a couple seconds to relax. All right. You can see the circle growing, where 3 community samples were 4 to 6 miles from the tailings. And finally, the 2 remaining samples came from 6 to 8 miles from the tailings. So I just wanted to give you a sense of the study area and where the community samples were collected or by the community for the project. So next slide, if we go to slide 57, is the introduction slide to the citizen science program. So in these images, these are showing the 2 different trainings that occurred, and I'll be going into more detail as we proceed. So on slide 58, you'll see the hypothesis of the citizen science program is that by having the community participate in an environmental science project, there will be an increase in their understanding of environmental science and the scientific method, their ability to discuss environmental issues and make more informed decisions will increase. Perhaps there's an increase in participation in community advisory boards and volunteering, and there perhaps would be a motivation to take action. So just quickly to define citizen science, it's where you have non-scientists participating in a science project where they'll be contributing in a variety of, they can contribute in a variety of ways from the idea to sample collection. And the goal is that you hope that they're also increasing their own knowledge as stated with the hypothesis. So on slide 59, as a citizen scientist, they completed a pre-survey and they participated in the training like you see in the images below, and they took a toolkit home. So you can see those high-tech toolkits, you know, on the tables in the bottom left images. You can see there's a couple buckets and some paper towels, some plastic bags, a trough, some other great things. They also received their individual and now are starting to hear the whole community sample results, and they took a post-survey to determine the potential impact of garden roots. So just really quickly, the recruitment materials that were used to generate the, and maintain the citizen science program, there was a promotional bookmark. I designed a website that you can visit and learn about the mission as well as what's going on. A press release was given out by the Yavapai County Extension Office. There was letters were sent to community members who had shown interest. And I'd really like to highlight their newsletter announcement. The Dewey Humboldt newsletter is widely distributed and I think was one of the best recruiting methods that I used. Slide 61 is showing the communication and or just the instructional manual. And I highlight this because it was a communication design challenge to create an instructional manual that was aesthetically pleasing as well as informative. Next slide. So here you can see, sorry, it looks like this got a little corrupt during the transfers, but it still looks good. I mean, don't get I'm just kidding. Okay. So next slide, 63. So really the outcomes, if we look at the people, I think that over 300 people were contacted through those the Agua Fria Festival I had mentioned earlier, through the recruitment products that I showed previously. So what happened is 43 community members signed up and actually received the kit. So these are people who came to training and took a kit home. After the project was over, at the end, 25 kits were returned. So when I say kits returned, that means that they returned soil, water, and or vegetable samples to me for analysis. So one question, if you're doing outreach or if you're kind of an engagement or outreach scholar, you really want to know what happens. Why do you lose people during a project? So my favorite is we're too old. I thought that was they signed up and then I called and they're just like, what are you doing? You know, we don't have time for this. We're getting old. So, but otherwise, I just think this is interesting to keep an eye on like what happens when you start a project and how you lose people. Next slide. I won't go into detail with this, but a way to maintain ongoing communication, well, I did maintain ongoing communication through phone, email, and actual snail mail mailings, and as well as provided informal science educational experiences throughout the project. And this was really done to manage community expectation and involvement, and also really to maintain them, to keep them engaged in garden roots so they would complete the study, collect the vegetables, submit them to me, and then, you know, continue to be part of the project. So this is just highlighting the science behind garden roots, the results for lunch, what happened, I'll go into more detail in the following slides, but where they received the results, a community health talk where University of Arizona toxicologists and public health professionals came to the town to discuss the issues, as well as gardening seminars. So next slide is, I'll start talking about the actual vegetable results. So you can see here, these are the vegetables being dried out after being washed in a hydrochloric acid solution. This solution was to remove all soil particles to ensure that I was only measuring what was in the edible portion of the plant. Next slide. So looking at arsenic concentrations in community yard and garden soils, you can see that the garden soils are in brown, the yard are in this blue color, and you also, just for reference, I added the Arizona residential soil remediation level at 10 milligrams of arsenic per kilogram of soil, and we can see where these community values lie. Something that was interesting was that 12 of the community kits' garden soils were greater than the yard soil. So this raised just an interesting question and perhaps further research. If you go to the next slide, looking at when they were asked in their survey, you know, what nutrients or amendments will you be adding to your garden this year? And so when I saw those values, you know, I created a This is like a frequency distribution, so the larger the word, the larger number of respondents who put that as their amendment. And we can see that the majority of this community is amending with compost and manure. The total number of vegetables analyzed within the greenhouse and the community totals to 108, and I divided out all the samples by family. So I'll be referring to, so you see lettuce, bean, radish, onion, tomato, squash, and beets, and you can see that they're divided into their scientific families. That will be the way they'll be represented throughout the rest of the presentation. Move on to slide 70. So we're going to be sitting with this slide for a little bit of time. So these are all the vegetable samples by scientific family analyzed in Garden Route. The values from the greenhouse study are represented as hollow shapes and are the average of four microcosms. I would like to point out the variance in garden soil concentrations in the community samples, ranging from 3 milligrams per kilogram to 400. That's not including the greenhouse study, but this is the range found within the community garden soils. And also showing that the edible tissue arsenic concentrations by fresh weight really vary by several orders of magnitude, as shown here. For reference, actually, let's look at the legend really quick. Within the legend, they're in order of bioaccumulation factors. So we can see here that the family Asteraceae, followed by the radish or Brassiceae, and then following Liliaceae, were the top three bioaccumulators from the samples received through Garden Roots. If you look at the two black horizontal lines going through the graph, you can see that these are the U.S. Food and Drug Administration Market Basket Study values. So what they do is they go to supermarkets, select a random array of products, and analyze them for different elements. And so the top line is the market study value for lettuce, and the bottom line is the market basket study for the rest of the majority of the remaining families. And so it's important to show here that the majority of the Garden Roots vegetable samples analyzed are above this U.S. FDA value. And let's move on to the next slide. So really quickly, I want to apologize. The U.S. FDA line is lower than it should be. But what the importance of the next two slides is to show that you can now divide out these vegetables by scientific family and look and isolate them and look at how they operate in terms of the arsenic concentration in the tissue versus soil arsenic concentration. And so we can see here that if we put that line where it's supposed to be, where these concentrations lie. And again, the hollow values are from the greenhouse. So next slide. So this is looking at the squash and cucumber family. So in this case, most of the values are below the market basket study and are really kind of staying in a flat line area except for one outlier, but really staying below that 0.006 milligrams per kilogram. Next slide. So that's really looking at the concentrations overall, if we're on slide 73. And what I want to do now is transition into the risk characterization. So now that we have the actual arsenic concentrations and the edible tissue of the vegetable samples, what do those mean in terms of risk? So you see here, this is what I'm going to be referring to as the risk continuum. You see lower risk in purple, medium risk in blue, higher risk in orange. And so what I'm going to do in the next slides is I'm going to show you the risk ranges by scientific family. Next slide on 74. So the incremental excess lifetime cancer risk range for each vegetable family, so for the first one, the Asteraceae, which is the lettuce, we can see that that ranged between one out of 10,000 to one out of a million, following by the Brassiceae family, which includes the radishes, is about 10 to the negative 5, so one out of 100,000 to 10 to the negative 7. And the onion and garlic family, Liliaceae, is around 10 to the negative 6 to 10 to the negative 7. Next slide. And now you can also see the way that the rest of the families fall. And we can see that Amarantia, which is beets and Swiss chard, you know, again, that 1 out of 10,000 to 1 out of 10 million. And then Kerbits are really, you know, ranging from that 1 out of a million to 1 out of 100 million. And so on. So this was important to do just to be, as part of the risk assessment process or risk characterization process, using the results from the community and greenhouse. So I should state that these do show the results from the greenhouse and the community together. So transitioning onto slide 76, this is delivering results and risk communication. So these images are from the Results for Lunch event that I hosted, where each community member received a booklet of the results. Next slide. So this is what the results booklet looked like. So here you can see the kit number, the project title, and the date. And this was considered the translation of the results to empower them with the results so they can make more informed decisions on how they want to operate with their garden. So within this booklet, they are given concentrations in their soil, water, and vegetables. They're calculated cancer and non-cancer risk based on each individual vegetable and concentration found, how much they could eat at various target risks, as well as the nutritional content in the vegetables. So it was important to have the nutritional content to show that perhaps they're, you know, we're looking at arsenic concentrations, but there's a lot of other great things in the vegetable as well. If you go to slide 78, the risk calculation for how much you can eat. And this is where I calculated how much you could eat at the concentration found in the vegetable at a specific target risk. So the US EPA has set an acceptable target risk range from 1 out of 10,000 to 1 out of a million. So this is kind of where our society operates at. Next slide. So assumptions used to complete the calculations along with other risk assumptions that I won't go into detail, but if you want further information about that, please ask. I assumed that they would be eating the U.S. Department of Agriculture's recommended amounts that you can see in the orange table, and that they would only be eating that one vegetable from their garden to meet that USDA recommended amount for the vegetable group. So for example, if I was going to calculate if they had tomatoes, I assumed that they'd be eating 5 cups per week of tomatoes. And that's how the assumption I made to continue with the next set of calculations. So let's go to slide 80. So what I did for a visual aid is I showed how much can you eat a week at a target risk of 1 out of 100,000. So I said, oh, we have this acceptable risk range. Let's just take it, go in the middle. And so what you can see here is that the green portion represents how much, these colors got a little flipped, but just bear with me. These aren't actual values. These are just mock-ups for the presentation. But if we look at lettuce, you can see that you can eat about 1 3/4 cup per week from your garden, and the remaining should be store-bought. In the cases that I had to recommend store-bought, I ran the risk characterization for the concentration of arsenic from that USDA market-based study to ensure that the amount I was saying that from the store actually met the target risk that I'm stating here. So this was a very effective communication tool by creating a visual aid and really making it acceptable. I'm giving them, or understandable, I'm giving them the actual amount that they could eat at a certain target risk. So I thought I was doing great. And then I realized that I thought that it wasn't fair of me to tell them what their acceptable risk was, because that is a personal decision. That's not something, and this is why risk perception and communication can be so challenging, right, is that, you know, we give out these numbers, but it really comes down to the individual to make decisions about what they want to do. And so if you go to the next slide, 81, what I did is I told them, it's your choice to decide what target risk you want to use, and to make decisions about how many cups per week to consume from your own garden. So I took those acceptable risk ranges that I took from the purple representing 1 out of a million, the teal at 1 out of 100,000, and target or and orange being 1 out of 10,000, and I broke it down into how much they could eat based on those three different target risks. And then in the final column on the right, you'll see how that's just for comparison, I listed the amounts cups per week recommended by the USDA. And so this to me was a pivotal moment in transferring the results into an empowering act. This is not me telling them what to do. This is me informing them so they can make their own decisions. And I thought this went pretty well. So before I went into any of these details, before I actually gave them their kit, their results booklet, I explained what risk characterization was and the assumptions used in risk calculations, and then I gave it to them so they could have been educated on it and then look at the results with more informed eyes. Next slide. So one thing is with the risk, with the results for lunch, yes, I gave them the results. I explained to them what the results booklet was going to show. And then they have these values, right? But the thing is that that's important when you do education is that you follow up with information and materials that people can change if they need to, have the information to change their behavior. So this handout is entitled Recommended Practices for Safe Consumption of Homegrown Vegetables. So this is a supportive material so they can make different decisions or have information on how to behavioral changes they might need to make if they were uncomfortable with the amount they could eat from their garden. So this is something that I designed. If we go to the next slide, slide 83. So risk characterization was also done for arsenic in soils and irrigation water. So I've been really focusing mainly on the vegetables, but since they did submit soil and water samples, it was important for me to do the risk characterization for everything. So this is an abbreviated version of what they would have gotten in the result booklet. And so I showed them what I was doing, so incremental excess lifetime cancer risk, and I showed them what that was for yard and soil. And then I showed them where they lied for accidental soil ingestion on the risk continuum. So you can see how there's three dots, the yellow, the brown, and the blue, corresponding to yard, garden, and irrigation water. And I want to highlight here that though I did a scenario of 2 liters per day, they were supposed to submit irrigation water. So this is for the plants, but just in case, I ran this for them. Next slide. So again, like I stated, you want to back up what you're doing and provide people with more information so they can change their practices if necessary. So this is a recommended practices for garden preparation handout that they were given. I'd like to highlight that it refers a lot to our Arizona Cooperative Extension bulletins that have been already designed by researchers at the University of Arizona. So here they can read about ways to reduce the arsenic absorption by the vegetables, and I refer them to those bulletins so they can get more information. So again, educating, empowering, passing the baton with knowledge. Let's go to the next slide. Here is recommended practices for safe gardening. So one thing that would happen is they would see that accidental soil ingestion level, or they see what the value was or the risk was with accidental soil ingestion. And so this became pretty important in making sure that they did not track soils into their home, that they, designate certain clothes for gardening. So, again, ways to reduce their exposure and behavioral and practical changes. So if we go to slide 86, we'll see this is a transitional slide for garden roots impacts. And if we go back, I'm sorry. So really to highlight this, so what you see, that man showing, Mike showing, I shouldn't say his name. What you see is that is the pre and post survey. So when they began Garden Roots, they took the study, and at the very end, after they received the results, had gone through, sitting through the whole meeting, they took the post survey. And this was to evaluate any changes in knowledge, awareness, and perhaps behavior. So let's move on to 87. And so I'm still really just starting to dive into these, but there was an increase in 8 out of the 14 science questions. And so that's exciting to me, that there was an increase in the number of correct answers in 8 out of the 14 science questions. So here on the right, you can see they were asked to define what soils consist of. You can see that there was an increase in the number of people who got that answer right in the post-survey. The next question is asking true or false. Are private wells regulated? them having the awareness, going through the project, and now more people were aware that no, it is not regulated, it's in their own, that they need to take care of it themselves. Next slide. So one interesting thing when I would talk about this project among different researchers and academics is they'd be like, Monica, you do not want these people to stop eating vegetables, okay? So, well, I wanted to make sure that I looked at their behavioral outcomes. And so overall, the question was, overall, now that you have the results from your garden, will you eat fewer, eat more? But the majority stated they'll eat the same amount of vegetables. So that's good. They're still eating vegetables. Next slide. This one's saying, now that you have the results from your garden, will you reduce the amount of the time you spend gardening? And what I want to highlight here is the majority of people said they continue to garden like they did before in terms of time, but they'll change their gardening practices. And so this, to me, is really important in that they will continue to eat their vegetables, continue with their hobby. Gardeners are very prideful of what they grow and what they do. I mean, the vegetables I received from this community were beautiful. I mean, they did an amazing job as gardeners. And so it's exciting to me that their hobby, they'll maintain their hobby, and they will also continue to eat vegetables. So, again, they'll change their gardening practices to reduce any accidental or incidental soil ingestion. So this means that they won't eat while they garden and different activities like that. And this is where those handouts that I highlighted and showed that I designed with the tree and the words coming off of really come into play. Next slide. So I kind of whipped through this a little quick, but I'd like to highlight the vegetable results. So overall, the arsenic concentration in garden with vegetables were greater than store-bought vegetables, with the exception of the cucumber and squash family and some of the Solanaceae family values. The legend didn't fully show up on that graph page, but the bioaccumulation factors was Asteraceae, Brassiceae, Liliaceae, Amaranthaceae, Cucurbitaceae, and Solanaceae to Fabaceae. So we see that the top accumulator was the lettuce and the lowest accumulator was the beans. And this is a similar bioaccumulation factors and values were observed in the literature. So if you wanted any more information about that, I did a comparison, and it was very interesting to see that when I compared the bioaccumulation factors found in values across the world, the top two remained the same. So really, lettuce and Brassiceae were the top accumulators. And lastly, the incremental excess lifetime cancer risk really ranged between 10 to the negative 8 to 10 to the negative 4, and so that's summarizing all of them. Next slide. As we look at conclusions from the citizen science and risk communication portion of this project, I would argue and say that public participation allowed for both a greenhouse and field study, and this allowed for more data while having residents be part of something in their community and increase their own knowledge and awareness. Secondly, I'd like to stress that providing people the opportunity to decide their own acceptable risk is a very powerful risk communication educational activity. I think that by having this integrated into the project and the results for lunch meeting, I believe that they felt more empowered and at ease with the values is because I showed them everything and was incredibly transparent versus if I had just given them one value. And lastly, people will continue to eat their vegetables but will change their gardening practices. So again, this is really exciting to know that their behavioral practices will change to reduce their exposure, but they will continue to eat their vegetables for the nutrition. If we go to slide 92, I'll stand back up on my soapbox and say that building a relationship with the Dewey Humboldt Arizona community allowed me to conduct research and apply my mission statement to a Superfund site. So I'm very grateful, honored, and thankful for this opportunity. And I would argue that a valuable research project, so again, there's rigor applied to this, laboratory work, research translation efforts and public participation can be part of a valuable research project. And I'd like to highlight that due to the public participation or citizen science component of this project, new questions arose from the community data. Having the public be part of it allowed me to harness their knowledge and enthusiasm, as well as recognizing them as experts in their own right by being a member of the community. And it's been, so if we go to the next slide, 93, again, just a reminder of the supporters for this project. If we go to 94, I really want to give a really loud applause and thank you to the Garden-Root Citizen Scientists. Their participation made this project successful and allowed me to have such a large sample base. And these are just little snapshots of all the wonderful people I had the honor of working with. Next slide. Really special thanks to my advisors who have worked with me throughout this whole project. Janique Artiola, Mark Brisson, Raina Mayer. I'd like to give a shout out to Dr. A.J. Gandolfi, the former SRP, University of Arizona Superfund Research Program Director, who always pushed me to pursue a PhD, and Jeff Shalow from the Yavapai Cooperative Extension Agency, who helped me do the project. And I believe that's it. Thank you all so much.
Okay, thank you, Monica. Before we open the question and answer session to both presenters, I would like to take a few minutes just for questions directed to Ms. Ramirez-Andreotta. I've got a few coming up here on the simulcast, so we'll start with those, and then we'll open it up to the phones. A question from David Harvey at Lyondell Basel Industries in Corpus Christi, Texas asks, were any mine representatives involved in your Garden Roots project?
So, like retired miners or the actual, like PRP? So, I would say that the site owner and people from the mine were not Garden Roots participants. No. So the answer is no.
Okay. Another question from Lizzie Amora Applegate in Florida, DEP, in Tallahassee. She asked, were soil samples discrete samples, composite samples, or incremental samples?
They were composite samples. So if you... you can go to Garden Roots, so garden-roots.org, and you can look at the Garden Roots instructional manual. It didn't show up too well on this presentation, but they were told to do composite samples. So they selected an area, six spots within it, and dug down to the top 0 to 6 inches.
Another question coming in from Wendy Heiger-Bernays at the BUSRP. First of all, she says, thank you for your wonderful work and demonstration of the power and need for citizen scientists. On slide number 68, you identified amendments added to gardens. Did you measure the arsenic concentrations in any of the amendments? And also for your studies, are you examining total arsenic, or do you have any data on arsenic species?
Great questions, and thank you, BU. So, okay, on this slide 68, I didn't, so for the controlled greenhouse study, I amended so I had three soil treatments that I used within the greenhouse, and I amended each of those with 25% Miracle-Gro garden soil. And I did run the metals for the Miracle-Gro, and the arsenic concentration in Miracle-Gro. Hope none of them are on the line. Okay, the arsenic concentration in Miracle-Gro garden soil was about 4 milligrams of arsenic per kilogram of soil. So that is showing that a commercially available amendment does indeed add arsenic load to your soils. Your next question, this is total arsenic. I apologize that I didn't specify that in the very beginning. This is all total arsenic. I am interested in doing some arsenic speciation perhaps in the future or passing the project on.
Okay. And David Harvey wrote in to say that, yes, he was asking about mine PRPs being involved, so the answer to that was no, correct?
Yeah, no, they were welcome to be part of it. I think everybody in the community was welcome. And, again, the recruitment materials are important to highlight that I was at, you know, majority of the community advisory board meetings. I attended a couple of town hall meetings, And again, we have other projects going on in Iron King Mine, and so we are working closely with one of the PRPs. So maybe they just don't have a local garden.
That's true.
Yep.
Another question from Sheila Abraham with the Ohio EPA. She asked, to calculate risk, as you described on slides 73 to 75, did you assume that the garden produce was 100% of the total consumed, or did you apportion consumption from the garden as a certain percentage of the market basket? So were you assuming they were eating 100% from their garden?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I would assume that to meet the need to, so you're saying if we go to, are you talking slides? Does she refer to slide 75?
You mentioned 73 to 75.
Okay, so 73 to, so if we go to 75, so these calculations, what I used for intake values were what had been reported in the U.S. EPA exposure handbook for homegrown produce. So that handbook was very helpful, and they have a section on, you know, they break it up by where you live, so I used the values, the intake rate values for non-metropolitan, home-produced vegetables and non-metropolitan communities.
Okay. We have more questions on the simulcast, but I'd like to take a moment to ask if anyone on the phone has any questions. If you'd like to ask a question, you can unmute your phone by pressing *7, state your name and organization, and then ask your question. Then you can remute by pressing *6. Do we have any questions on the phone line?
Yes, Joyce Cooley with Exponent. Thank you for that presentation. That was very interesting what you've done here, and there's so many things that you've looked at. It's very helpful. I had a question also about 73 to 75, the risk characterization. For risk communication, shouldn't you be presenting the difference in risk or the increase in risk between eating garden vegetables from their gardens versus store-bought? Because they have to eat vegetables, and even store-bought vegetables have some arsenic in it. It's in everything.
Yeah, that's a good point. I wanted to focus on their homegrown vegetables primarily because, one, when I talk to them, they do eat the majority. I should say I have to go back through my survey results to actually see what the breakdown is from their garden versus store-bought. But the other thing is that I had some issues with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's their results report. So in some cases, they would report. Well, this is something I could have I can follow up with them on. But in some cases, I didn't feel comfortable using their values. They would report zeros instead of the LOD, and so I had some issues with working with that. So I didn't feel comfortable doing the full risk characterization with their numbers. But you do bring up a good point.
And a related question is, why was it assumed that store-bought produce would have less arsenic in it when the soils that produce those vegetables are unknown?
I didn't assume. So you're saying in the pie charts where it said that you could have a certain amount of store-bought, so what that means is that if there was a listed value from the market basket study, I used that arsenic concentration in the risk calculation to determine that what I was saying they could eat. So, for example, using the concentration found in the market basket study said that they could consume 10 cups a week, then I knew that as long as I reported to the community that they could have 10 cups or less, that that would be in an acceptable range.
A question from Amy Hargrove at the Washington State Department of Ecology in Lacey, Washington. Did the irrigation water contain elevated levels of arsenic, or was it only in the soil? And also, what were the lead levels?
Great question. I did not put in the irrigation water slide. But yes, about their irrigation water, I'm trying to remember exactly how many, but there were many that were above the arsenic MCL. And so that is another contributing factor to the concentrations, or perhaps the concentrations found in the vegetables. If you're interested in those values, we can talk later. But, yes, I do have arsenic water concentrations.
And any comments on lead levels?
Oh, lead levels were also collected. The lead levels in the irrigation water were all below the MCL. I have lead values from the soils as well as within the vegetables. They were relatively low compared to the arsenic values, and the soil lead levels were below the residential screening numbers.
We have a series of questions continuing here from our simulcast participants. The next one is from Patty Wong of OEHHA in Sacramento, California. Are you planning a follow-up study to see if or how much changing garden practices improves the cancer risk from the homegrown produce consumption?
That's a great question. At this point, I have not designed a follow-up study for that. I'm just happy to know that their behavioral practices, that when I did give them the results, they stated that their behavioral practices would change.
Okay, a question from Robert Rice at UC Davis. What was the HCl concentration of the solution used to wash the vegetables, and would the vegetable cells be stable to this treatment?
It was 0.1 was the hydrochloric acid was used in the solution.
Okay.
And the pH was around 2, huh?
Would the vegetable cells be stable to that treatment?
Yes. That was a recommended practice by the labs I used and my advisor. So I maintained a certain pH, but that was the most important part of it.
The next question is from Aaron McVicker with AMEC.
Oh, yeah, and hold on, sorry, really quick. Just to follow up on that question, they were rinsed as well. So it was dipped into the 0.1 solution and then rinsed and dried.
So Aaron McVicker from AMEC, did you look for any correlation between distance to the tailings, to backyard garden, and concentration in the vegetables? E.g., were soils and hence vegetable concentrations higher, closer to the source?
That's a great question, and I have not started that portion. But so if you see in the beginning of the presentation where I kind of created those colorful bubbles of highlighting the areas samples were collected, that was the next idea. I was like, oh, I should have had, I should have put in those radiuses or diameters what the concentrations were and were found. So that's a really great suggestion, and we're thinking on the same page, and that's something I will be doing.
I'd like to take a moment to ask whether any phone participants have any questions before we get back to the simulcast questions.
And if there are any Dewey Humboldt people on the line, I would love to hear from you guys.
Okay, we'll go back to the simulcast questions. This is from Rob Baines at the Washington DOH in Olympia. I know this was arsenic-related, but in your meetings, did you discuss pesticide use and possible arsenic sources from non-organic chicken manure, et cetera?
Yes and no. So really in the pre- and post-survey were where I would capture those idiosyncrasies of their behavior in the garden, of what they were using. And so I didn't – that would be – I really didn't give focus to that. A majority of them, when I asked them if they how they gardened, the use of pesticides was not listed. But we did have a gardening seminar with the Yavapai Extension director where he covered organic and holistic different practices for gardening to reduce the use of their pesticides. So indirectly, I would say I captured that information, and it didn't stand out to me.
Okay, a question from Andy Gillette with LQM in Nottingham, UK. Was soil bioaccessibility testing considered as part of exposure and included in risk estimates, the soil ingestion pathway? Was soil bioaccessibility testing considered as a part of exposure and included in risk estimates, the soil ingestion pathway?
No. I only looked at eating vegetables, but there is, when I showed, I did look at incidental soil ingestion and gave them a calculated risk number for that, using, again, the U.S. EPA handbook values.
Eileen Hack from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management in Indianapolis asks, is there a way to distinguish between arsenic taken up through the roots compared to arsenic that may have been on the surface of the plant via dust, et cetera?
So that that's a great question, and that's exactly why I use such an aggressive cleaning process. So that was to make sure that the only thing I was measuring was the arsenic amount in the edible portion of the plant. So again, there was a rigorous washing that occurred with these vegetable samples to ensure that no soil particles were remaining on them during analysis.
Okay. Chris Geller from the New Jersey DEP in Trenton asks, were non-cancer endpoints used in communicating risk?
I do have the non-cancer endpoints. I did not go into them, but I do have those values.
Sophia Serta from EPA Region 9 in San Francisco asks, what were the 14 science questions asked to gauge increased knowledge?
I can follow up with you on that. I don't have the exact survey with me, but the science questions ranged from local and regional questions. So where do Arizona residents get their drinking water? So right there I'm looking for answers of groundwater and surface water to incorporate, questions like if you're running an experiment and you have over 20 values, what do you do with them? Do you only take the top number? Do you take the low number? Do you do an average? It's questions that looked at how they perceived the science, how much they knew about the scientific method, how much they knew about their local and regional environmental issues, and then also looking at very general science questions. One of them was like, how long does it take to produce a centimeter of soil type of things to, so I can show you those later, but there's 14 of them that I probably don't need to rattle off right now.
Okay. Shilpi Oberoi from the University of Pittsburgh asks, did you suggest the vegetables that should be grown, or did you allow the participants to decide based on their own choice? If you did suggest, was your suggestion based on prior studies for certain vegetables that bioaccumulate arsenic selectively?
That's a great question. So I allowed the community to grow whatever they wanted and submit that. That was mainly done, one, because of how much pride and how much people love to garden. I didn't want to impose on their creativity in their garden, so I let them grow whatever, I let them grow and submit whatever they wanted. For the controlled greenhouse study that I conducted with three soil treatments, I grew radish, lettuce, bean, and, radish, lettuce, bean, squash, which ended up not growing too well, and I can't believe I'm totally blanking out. I'm so sorry. Onion. Yes, thank you. So I grew those within the greenhouse, and I selected those vegetables. I made my own functionality or function of how to select vegetables. So the four that I used in the greenhouse were really based upon what had been used in the literature. So that I could use for comparison, what are culturally relevant vegetables, so that the information be accessible and relevant to more than just one cultural group, as well as what grows fast. That was another one, and also looking at documented arsenic plant toxicity levels.
Okay. The next question is from Keith Pizzoli at UC San Diego SRP, and he says, "Great presentation. In the course of your research, did you manage to get a sense of the extent to which brownfields could be converted to community gardens? I know there's interest among folks in the EPA and redevelopment agencies, but concerns about contamination of the soil is worrisome."
First of all, hello, Keith. It's been a while. Congratulations on refunding. Great question. So I would say that this project is definitely relevant to the revitalization of brownfield sites and the use for garden spaces and gardens. I think that, yes, it's relevant. I'm not sure. I would say that's actually a really, really good point. This information could be definitely presented and packaged to meet the needs of the project managers working at brownfield sites to look at and strategize how to create these community gardens in these brownfield areas. And I would say that if you saw, again, the soil concentrations that were submitted from the community ranged from 3 milligrams per kilogram up to around almost 400. And so I do have a wide variety of data on that. So that would be a really good spot for it to go. Thanks so much for bringing that up.
If we have any questions from the phone, just a reminder, you can press star 7 to unmute and ask your question. Any questions on the phone? Okay, we've just got a few more here on the simulcast before we wrap up. This is from Amy Patton, Patton Environmental in Ashland, Oregon. What differences did you see in arsenic levels from gardens near the Superfund site versus larger ones? She apologizes if she had missed any of the questions. You don't have to repeat it if you had answered this. But a second part to that was, did you conclude that the Superfund site is the primary source of arsenic, or is there naturally occurring arsenic in the area?
So the way I would answer that question is, one, by stating Yavapai County has, because of the geology in the area, naturally has high levels of arsenic in their soils, which also, and in the parent rock material, which can lead to high naturally occurring high levels of arsenic in the groundwater, and that's been documented and within the literature for this county. So in terms of me saying the high concentration in their soils are directly from the mine versus naturally, I can't say that. I know that if for more information on that, I would recommend looking at the EPA's investigative report and feasibility study, where they attempted to characterize the type of arsenic in the tailings to what was found in the soils. One thing that they did say in that IR report was that the top layers of soils, so 0 to 6 inches, did have elevated arsenic levels when compared to 6 to 12 inches and below. And so that is documented in their study. That does point to the fact that there was wind erosion from the tailings and distributing it throughout the community. And so I would refer to that document and say that they have made that statement that because of the top levels having elevated levels of arsenic when compared to below 6 to 12 inches, that their inclination is it's due to the wind erosion from the tailings and other spots. Or I'll just say erosion in general. It can be water or aeolian.
Okay, and we have a follow-up question to one of the earlier ones. Shilpi Oberoi of the University of Pittsburgh asks, do you have any reason to believe that high arsenic level in only the irrigation water and not the soil would cause elevated arsenic level in the cultivated vegetables?
That's a really good question and something that I'm really going to attempt to tease out because there's a really good paper that came out from a group that did some research in Bangladesh that we're looking at irrigation water and then just the water that's available to the plants. And they were pointing the direction that elevated irrigation water is impacting the crops. But that's not something I've looked at yet with the Garden Roots Project. But thank you for prompting me. It would be important.
Okay. In just a moment, we will open the question and answer to both presenters in case anyone had any lingering questions for Dr. Kamanish. But in the meantime, I wanted to make sure everyone is aware of the links page and online feedback forum. On the links page, we have assembled various resources directly applicable to today's topic, and it will stay with the seminar indefinitely so that you can access it after the presentation. The seminars are typically placed in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms. In particular, we'd be very interested to find out how the audience felt about the combination of health and field subjects in a combined study. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation. I'll just double check now if we have any questions left to ask of either presenter. You can unmute your phone with star 7 or type one in on the simulcast.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then I will remind you that you can contact Monica and Todd via the email addresses that are listed on the additional resources page, so you're welcome to follow up there with any additional questions. Someone had asked, was there contact information? So yes, you are welcome to contact the presenters with further questions and follow-up information. Oops, we got one last, just at the stroke of midnight here. The last question from Carrie Christensen, State of Oregon Public Health Division. Do you have information on how far in advance amendments were added in the garden soil prior to the sample collection by the residents? And do you have any resources that we can access on messaging or education around this topic?
So for the first part of your question, during the trainings, I guided them to take the sample right when they start, you know, to do the sample after they have amended and were ready to plant. So right when they were ready to start putting some seeds in, that's when they were recommended to take that sample. The second question about...
Resources for messaging or education on the topic. Do you have things they can access?
So at this point, I don't have things you can access, but I'm working on packaging everything in a way that you can, that people can access and download and run the calculations and just throw the numbers into the results booklet. And so this is something that I'm working on to really make Garden Roots usable for other projects and other people across the country. I'm excited about doing that portion. You know, having the, you know, I have a strong interest in art and graphic design, and so I put a lot of time and energy into creating these materials so that they were aesthetically pleasing and fun to use. And so I do want to make those more widely usable for everyone. So in the coming months, or, you know, when I graduate, so by the end of 2012, there'll be something out there for usage.
Great. Well, we will close the questions at this point, and I would like to thank both of our presenters today, Dr. Todd Kamenish and Ms. Monica Ramirez-Andreata, for their time in preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. This will conclude today's presentation. Thank you all for your participation. And if any SRP or EPA personnel are interested in setting up a similar collaborative seminar series in your region, feel free to contact me for more information. Thank you all. Goodbye.